Quit laughing.
I'm trying.
Welcome to Gola. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, an assistant professor in Italian at Dartmouth College and a certified specialist of wine.
Hello. What's up?
Hey, Katie. How are you?
Amazing. How are you? Thanks for asking.
I'm doing pretty well. Yeah, I think things are looking up in general. We're recording just after having heard the news that we'll have a new president come January 2021. So you may hear some noise from outside of my office where I'm sitting as students and faculty and general population of the town of Hanover are running around and honking their horns and feeling democratic. I'm also almost done with the quarter here in Hanover. We're wrapping up in just a couple of weeks. And I'm feeling like the end of this year will be good because it will allow us to put to bed some of the unpleasant memories and start fresh, which is always a good thing.
Totally. But what are you teaching in the meantime? Like, what's your first Dartmouth semester look like?
So I am just finishing up teaching Dante's Inferno for my students here. Always my great pleasure to do in any case, but I had a lovely class and we had a great time just reading the very last canto of Inferno last week. And the coming week, we'll just get to have our lecture time dedicated to general discussion. And that's my favorite time because the students have had a moment to kind of internalize, and I use the word digest a lot, everything that they've read. And it's really interesting. You would think that it would take some acrobatics to make medieval poetry relevant to 21st century college students. But I will tell you, I do not have to do much work to get them amped about it. So you know what? That of all the things to be optimistic about, teaching does it every time because you finish up a several weeks of working really hard. And then you hear from these young, bright minds that they change the way they think about something, or they felt like they feel like they've grown or actively learned something. And your heart gets a little bit bigger every time.
Yeah. I mean, of course the Inferno is relevant. We live in hell, but
A joke.
Are these Italian students? Are you teaching in Italian, or are these like literature students and Italian studies majors?
Yeah, it's a mixture. So I get a lot of students of Italian, but I actually get a lot of students in general. Dartmouth's a smaller college, so I have a smaller class now, and I'm also new here, so people are getting to know me. But at Berkeley, I used to get 60, 70 students in a lecture, no problem. Oh. And they would be from all over the place, from computer science, from public policy, environmental studies, all kinds of stuff besides what you know, besides usual suspects in terms of literature, history, and of course, Italian or other languages, European languages.
I wish I could take your class. I like actually didn't take any Italian literature classes at all in college to the detriment of my formal Italian.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know what? College is a tough time for everyone. I think that we kind of all underestimate how much is meant to be accomplished in those few years and how realistic our goals are. I mean, I wouldn't go back to being 19 for any amount of money right now, to be honest. I feel like every year I get older, I become more competent and enjoy the opportunities laid before me better. And I think in those transition years from being a child to trying to sort of approach becoming an adult, trying to at the same time as those things learn about something like another culture's creative production, literature included, is a real challenge. Appreciating those things is hard at that time. And one of the things that makes my job so satisfying is that I get to go back to school every day, literally. And I get to redo all the things that I wish I had done better the last time each year. So,
yeah, totally. I mean, it wasn't until I was 38 years old that I woke up at an hour that would have been like appropriate for taking Italian literature classes in college.
I teach in the afternoon.
All the Italian studies classes were at like 8 and 9 a.m. And I'm like, bruh, like, ouch. Like, I really wanted to enroll in them.
Yeah, you knew you weren't going to make it. That's all right.
I mean, I've known myself for a long time, and I did like have a copy of Dante's Inferno with like the English and the Italian facing one another, like that classic volume in high school. So I like read it-ish, but that was over 150 years ago. So I mean, the text itself hasn't changed, but it's not like super fresh in my mind.
No, it's a lot of text to work with also. I have students who have read it a few times before, and then they come in and take class with me, and they tell me that they can't believe how much they learned reading it after having thought they had read it. And that's what makes it worth reading, right? The richness of a text like that.
I think it'd be like kind of cool to do a little Dante's Inferno pod. I don't know if you're up for that.
Dude, I'm literally doing it anytime. Like, find me anytime. I'm always doing that. Just record me. All I'm doing.
I'm into that kind of thing.
No prep necessary. Yeah, absolutely. That'd be a lot of fun. The other thing we have that I definitely want to drop in here, because when this episode comes out, it will be pretty close for most people. We are doing a live Gola taping on December 2nd for the University of Massachusetts at Boston Italian Studies program that is supported by a wonderful fund for Italian culture. And we will be in the same place, I think, if the world doesn't end before then. Katie and I will be safely distanced, but near enough to look into each other's eyes and talk about Italian food for a wide audience on Zoom. And all the details will be available through our social media platforms and elsewhere. But look out for that on December 2nd at 5 p.m. Eastern. The link to register will be everywhere you find us in the virtual world coming up shortly.
I'm so excited about that.
I'm really excited too, actually, for lots of reasons. Speaking of things that will help make this complicated year come to a warm and delightful end, the live taping is just going to be the absolute best cherry on top. And approaching you from a safe distance will also make me feel very good.
Yay. Looking forward to it.
Well, Katie, you must have some other stuff. What's going on, man? You're working like crazy, and that work usually materializes into a book at some point. What have you got on the back or front burner right now?
Well, I've been editing the first round of edits of Untitled Pizza Cookbook. The title, well, it's not really untitled anymore, but we haven't announced it yet, so TBD.
Okay.
So that's what I'm working on at the moment. I also just launched virtual wine tastings and cocktail seminars. So anyone who's interested in those, they're sort of like private tastings and seminars where we like Zoom and we talk about sometimes classic Italian cocktails. I'm doing a really fun Lambrusco themed wine tasting with a group of friends who will each be in like their own separate apartments. And that's going to be on Monday. It's super fun to like look forward to that through the weekend. And then tons of people like want to do Thanksgiving tastings because they're not going to be traveling with their families to visit their families. So they're just like gifting family members wine tastings that they sort of like crash in on. So it's a super fun initiative. And what's great about it is it's customized. So wherever you happen to be, whether you're in like Omaha or San Francisco, I connect with your local wine shop or liquor store. I see what they've got and basically like create set of itineraries for you to choose from. So let's say you're really interested in like the wines of Sicily or specifically the wines of Etna. If that's the type of selection you have, we can do that. Or like the white wines of northeastern Italy or the reds of Abruzzo and south central Italy. So it's really cool that way. Once we do this wine tasting, you can sort of keep the like fun going by going to your local wine shop and getting those bottles again and maybe even giving your friends a wine tasting. So I find that this is like a pretty fun way to like keep people excited about Italian culture. And I mean, it's not hard to get people excited about Italian culture when they're drinking, obviously, but giving them tools they can use and apply. Like most of my wine tastings in Rome take place at wine bars where we taste awesome stuff, but it's not necessarily exported. And this way you really get like a very practical lesson in what is available in your area. So that's been a cool launch. And I know I've got some other stuff going on, but I forget because I was up all night editing last night, and that's how my brain works.
Well, that sounds awesome. I know I've been doing tons of virtual tastings. Now it's been months. We were hoping that we would be doing more things in person by now, but I have found the same thing, that people have really enjoyed it as a gift giving mechanism. And I know I'm getting tons of requests coming up now that we're basically entering the holiday season, but it's been a lot of fun, more fun than I thought it would be. And I agree that especially the element of sourcing things close to people and helping them to find a shop that's near them that they can patronize and continue to go back to has been great. And the stuff that I do is usually much more history focused. So not everyone is as pumped about hearing me drone on about the deep medieval roots of whatever grape they're tasting. But, you know, sometimes around Thanksgiving, people change their tune and kind of like that connection. So any way you cut it, it's a nice way to feel close to the people you care about in a moment when you maybe can't be close to them. Speaking of wine, we did Pinot Grigio last time. People listened to us, and wine needs to be paired with its best friend, cheese, as you well know, Katie.
Absolutely.
And that made us think of a cheese that sort of sits in an interesting gray area, because it isn't the quote unquote king of cheeses, Parmigiano Reggiano. It isn't like our friend mozzarella, the kind of rarefied fresh cheese space of that sort of becomes an experience that you can only have in the place in situ. But it is, in some ways, maybe the most representative Italian cheese, because it is everywhere all the time and appears in many different forms.
Drum roll. Okay, so I was trying to dig up like the drum roll effect on GarageBand, but I did not succeed. So drum roll, and then fill it in with your imagination.
Imagine a drum roll. Imagine us having a proper production team.
Suspense.
And it's pecorino. Oh my God. Everyone's jaws dropped. I know. Katie, why do you want to talk about pecorino and what is it?
I want to talk about pecorino because I really deeply, deeply treasure shepherd culture. And
sorry, but that's the one. That's so good. Wow. I cannot wait. That's going to go on all of the gold t-shirts when we finally get that merch rolled out.
You know how I feel about shepherd culture.
I do. I just love that was like the best possible delivery.
No, you know, I live in Rome, which is a city like allegedly founded by shepherds. And until pretty recently, lambs and sheep graze through the Roman Forum and the adjacent areas. Like you can still just take a short walk away from the Circus Maximus and be at a caseificio or like a cheesemaker in like a Renaissance casale and have pecorino, which is just a really generic name for sheep's milk cheese. So pecorino romano is probably the most famous, pecorino sardo, another famous one. But when you hear the word pecorino, you're just hearing the word in Italian for sheep's milk cheese. And right, it takes all different forms. And is really, it's not specific to South Central Italy. You can find it all over Italy, but it really is sort of synonymous with the cooking of Lazio and Rome in particular, because the Pecorino Romano's roots are in antiquity in that part of Italy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll take that as my cue to talk about the deeper history here real quick, because as we were chatting before the show, we were thinking about the fact that while we reference cheese a lot and we have talked about it in a couple other places, one of the first episodes we ever did was about mozzarella di bufala. But cheese is something that we, I don't think, have kind of approached in a coherent and comprehensive way. And it is one of the oldest foods. It's actually, in terms of human history, it's one of the foods that we know it pre-exists written history. People have been making cheese for as long as they've been telling other people what they eat, and since even before that. So when you talk about pecorino having a long history in Lazio, we can talk about it in a way that is very precise when it comes to a long history, at least as far back as the famous treatise by Columella. I'm sure we must have at some point mentioned De Re Rustica, but the early agricultural treatise that comes out of ancient Rome talks about cheese making and specifically pecorino. So certainly even before that, so we have in the Odyssey, the Cyclops makes cheese, specifically sheep's cheese. And
that would have been happening in Sicily, right? From a sort of geographic
standpoint. Yeah, exactly. And then probably in many places around the peninsula, but certainly Rome to Naples area, we know that there's a lot of pecorino production. Virgil, in his poetry, makes mention of the distribution of a piece of a ration of pecorino going to Roman soldiers alongside their bread and other grain ration. So people have been eating pecorino in Italy for thousands of years in the geographic space that is now Italy, but they have beyond that, even more than that, which is really interesting to us, been eating specific styles of cheese, and in this case, specific styles of pecorino associated with specific geographic areas for thousands of years also. So when you talk about people's relationship with this particular food product, you're talking about something that has the kind of evocative potential of basically the same kinds of things that we were talking about at the beginning of this, like Dante's poetry or Virgil's poetry in this case, something that has a kind of cultural import that is far outsize in terms of what our expectation is when it comes to cheese, I think, anyway.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, we mentioned earlier that there are different types of pecorino. The milk is the constant, but what changes is the temperature at which the cheese production is happening and the acidity, which all of the enzymes are active when the whey is separated from the curd. These influence the final texture of the cheese. So if you're thinking about Pecorino Romano and instances in which you've either purchased it or been served, you know it's a hard salted grating cheese. It is something that you really have to cut with a knife if you're just eating it sort of as a table cheese. Whereas a lot of the pecorini in Tuscany and even other parts of Lazio and Sardinia are much softer. And then to sort of throw in variables, a lot of pecorino, especially the harder pecorino, is at times either aged further in fosse or caves, or in botte, walnut barrels often, or just botte is just barrel, but walnut tends to be one of the choices, wrapped in fig leaves or ash or the crushed grapes that are left over when you press them for wine. There are all of these ways in which you can impart additional flavor to a pecorino, but there's only one Pecorino Romano by definition, right? This is sheep's milk cheese that's produced in a delimited area. It is governed by a DOP, and that appellation stipulates that in order to be labeled Pecorino Romano, the cheese must be produced from the milk of sheep in Grosseto, which is the southernmost county in Tuscany, all of the region of Lazio, and all of the region of Sardinia. So we've talked a lot about this in other podcasts, and there are a lot of instances in which the commercial viability of the product leads its traditional production area to be expanded in order to allow greater production. And that's absolutely the case for Pecorino Romano, which is actually mainly produced in Sardinia and not in and around Rome at all. In fact, there are only a handful of historic Pecorino Romano producers in the Rome metro area, whereas there are tens of thousands of people employed in Pecorino Romano production in Sardinia.
Well, and that brings us to the kind of other question there, which is that as you're describing Pecorino Romano made in Sardinia, there is also simultaneously Pecorino Sardo, just as you say, the southernmost part of Tuscany is included in the DOP area of production for Pecorino Romano, so too there is Pecorino Toscano. So we have a lot of overlapping both of the regions of production and the styles, but each of them is, wherever they're being made, kind of becoming known for certain characteristics. And you're mentioning things like the constant of milk versus the other things that might change to create different flavors. What does Pecorino Romano taste like? And then what is it? How do we contrast that with others in terms in the Pecorino world?
Pecorino Romano is salted. It can be very savory. The DOP allows a range of salinity, salt, the sort of salting of the cheese. And so you tend to find that local production, like the production in and around Rome, is more intensely salty than production elsewhere. The local production is meant for the salt-loving Roman palate, and the other production is meant for a global, either an Italian or a global audience. And just a footnote, when you encounter things like cacio e pepe, amatriciana, carbonara, these are Pecorino Romano-laced dishes. It's quite tangy. It's got an intense flavor, and it's been salted, which takes out a lot of its humidity, so it doesn't melt. We're not talking about sort of the soft slice of pecorino that you might find on a bruschetta in Tuscany, for example.
Yeah, and that is, I think, the firmest distinction. That is, oh my God.
Extra fun.
Points on the board for Caligari. The Pecorino Toscano that I was used to eating in Tuscany when I lived there for years was mostly a fresh or semi-fresh cheese that is often, exactly as you mentioned, Katie, put on a bruschetta or is allowed to get a little bit melty possibly, or sometimes traditionally paired with fava beans, and something that you also see in Sardinia. But it is distinctly different from the Pecorino Romano, which is, and I love how bracingly salty real Pecorino Romano is. It's one of my favorite things. But to call the fact that they both go under the same name would seem bizarre, I think, to someone who doesn't have familiarity with the regions and having eaten them there. In Tuscany, in fact, you'll see a lot of times the Pecorino Marzolino, which means that it's being made in March, and or that it was traditionally made in March, and is this kind of fresh style that goes along with the idea that it is a fresh seasonal cheese to be eaten basically right after it's made. The total opposite of what your experience would be with a Roman pecorino that is going to theoretically last for eons, even though you shouldn't really let it dry out that much.
Yeah. And I mean, that's sort of the genius of cheese making. It allows a totally perishable product, dairy, to last a lot longer. In the case of a fresher cheese, months. In the case of Pecorino Romano, a year or more.
Well, so, you know, speaking of making dairy last, I think we might be able to take a short leap to your shepherd friends and talking about itinerancy and the idea of moving both the animals and the cheese that they make. What's the deal with shepherds, and why are you thinking of them so much when you think pecorino?
I'm thinking about shepherds all the time, even if I'm not thinking about pecorino, because there are a number of like features of like shepherding life that have always struck me as fascinating. One is the transumanza, and that is the ritual during which shepherds move their flocks from the mountains in the summertime down to the coast in the wintertime and back again. And it's this like beautiful cycle of moving the sheep and lambs to places where the climate permits them to eat a sort of buffet of herbs and wild grasses. And the transumanza used to be like a really bustling tradition because there were a lot more shepherds in Italy, even as recently as the 1960s. But as Italy becomes a more urban and industrialized nation, those agricultural jobs start to diminish, particularly as like sort of massive cheese making factories import milk or mechanize the whole system. And that's a mid to late 20th century phenomenon. Another sort of migration feature, which always fascinated me, is how in the 50s and 60s in the post-war capital, Roman shepherds sort of moved up in the world and got jobs in the bureaucracy, working at City Hall or in other levels of government. And the shepherding jobs were taken by Sardinians who were enlisted on the island and brought over to Rome and its environs to graze the sheep that Romans no longer were interested in grazing. And there's this, you know, we talk about Armando al Pantheon all the time, but I love the story that Claudio Gargioli tells me when he was growing up in his father Armando's trattoria about how, you know, they would have to sort of like make the most of their, what was then a very simple kitchen space. So he would like head out every day with a tray of meat that he would bring to the bakery down the street, and in the portico of the Pantheon would be all the, basically like the shepherds waiting for gigs, like freelance shepherds. And he would, you know, go pick the meat up again. The bakery wasn't being used for baking bread anymore. It had shuttered for that purpose for the day. So the family would use the bread oven to cook their meat. He would bring it back. And then at lunchtime, all the shepherds who hadn't gotten gigs would come in and pound beers, like hard. And this was like, you know, pre Armando of today. Like, the place opened in 1963. It feels like it's a place right out of history, but it's changed over time. And there used to be tables that were set up for, you know, very simple daily special dishes, and you would sit down and be served those. And then there were other tables that were for like the Sardinian shepherds and others who would just come in, have some drinks, bring their own lunch, or maybe just share some snacks. So if you can imagine like rowdy tables of pastori sardi drinking beer, and they like, I mentioned this, they would go pretty hard. And that's kind of like it's an interesting cultural thing as well. Like when you go to Sardinia, you run into like groups of shepherds all the time in Cagliari or Alghero, like even in cities, they're often there for political protest, as you know, there's a very strong activism streak in the Sardinian shepherd community. And when they're out at City Hall, you'll see them at bars, like drinking a lot of Ichnusa, which is Sardinian. Well, I guess it's not maybe owned by a Sardinian company anymore, but it used to be like the classic Sardinian lager.
They did.
And it's, you know, it's a really striking reminder that while there's not a lot of like hard boozing going on in the peninsula, there are certain parts of Italy that do embrace like a boozier culture, and Sardinian shepherds are among them. And then on the sort of note of political protests and activism, as you can imagine, like with a global pecorino market, there are all sorts of difficulties that shepherds face, especially small scale farms face, in sort of making their businesses work. It takes about 6 liters of sheep's milk to make 1 kilo of pecorino. In the sort of turn of the 21st century heyday, shepherds would get €1 a liter for milk. Now they're getting closer to 60 cents a liter 20 years later. And if you follow Sardinian news or sort of Italian agricultural news, you know that there are active protests against these price changes and the difficulties that shepherds face. And often these are quite dramatic events in which highways will be blocked and shepherds will come and dump out their milk and flood highways with milk, sort of symbolizing that it's worthless. It's not being paid for properly and therefore has no value. Oh, I just also want to clarify one thing. The protests are undertaken by shepherds, right? They're the ones that are milking the sheep, I guess, ewes. And the cheese producers tend to be a totally separate entity.
Right. So that we have kind of 3 different spaces here. One, the people who are obtaining the milk; two, the people who are producing and then marketing the cheese that comes from it; and then 3, the people who are consuming it. And all of them have different interests and often aren't talking to each other.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's also the reality of the very, very large and powerful supermarket systems in Italy and Europe. So like Coop and other supermarket chains can sort of dictate what they're willing to pay. And if they're only willing to pay €4.60 a kilo for Pecorino Romano, and it costs €6 just for the milk, that's going to put, you know, various levels of the production and distribution chain at risk.
Right, exactly. And speaking of the value of the cheese, there is also another side of this that becomes, you know, kind of both politicized and that has economic consequences. And that's the exploitation of the recognizability of the brand. This is something that we've talked about with relation to all kinds of things. And it comes up very frequently in matters of Italian food discussion, because Italy has worked hard to protect the style in which certain foods are made, the connection to the space, the geographic and cultural reality in which it's made, and the quality levels, but that those protections then in turn become something that less scrupulous producers can take advantage of, or people can simply steal or parlay into their own, or, you know, fold into their own interests. And pecorino is one of the things, kind of like, I think we think of it as a little bit more intuitively expected in the case of Brunello or, you know, high-end Italian wines, even olive oil, as we've talked about frequently. But pecorino is one of those products that has this happen as well.
Yeah, I mean, especially considering the cost of production and the cost of labor and all of these things that contribute to its price. Like, if a company is unscrupulous, it can get away with importing foreign milk or foreign cheese and then just simply labeling it Pecorino Romano. And there have been instances of like whole shipments being caught on the autostrada or the Italian highways, and truckloads full of counterfeit cheese headed for Sardinia.
I mean, I do look forward to the heist film that we eventually make, where we're driving recklessly to the Strait of Gibraltar with a truck full of counterfeit cheese and hands. But it's a real problem that, of course, only then falls back down the chain to those same shepherds that you feel so close to, Katie.
The quote is, "I treasure them." Aside from the like super famous pecorino-based dishes like cacio e pepe, what are some of your go-to pecorino bites?
I was going to ask you the same thing, of course, and I'm sure you have a lot of good ones locked and loaded. I will tell you that when I think of pecorino, I almost always think of the simplest iteration of it, but that I think in some ways is kind of special because there is something inherently Italian about it, and that is just by itself, but with a mostarda or other kind of fruit conserve, or I don't know what language I'm speaking anymore, but, you know, fruit compote, maybe something like that.
Like a jam.
But like Italians like their jams much more bitter and or even spicy in a way, or like kind of hot, like intense. And pecorino, especially Tuscan pecorino, which, as we mentioned, is a lot more subtle, a little bit less salty, and just kind of a creamy palate. I love the combination of those things together. And I think when I see a big wheel of pecorino, which it's not that big, but, you know, it's not unusual for people to have the whole wheel at their house, for example, because pecorino is not that, is not huge. I just think of, yeah, just like taking a slice out of it and putting something that creates that salty, sweet contrast, which, as you know, I love.
I'm into that too. I love like a soft pecorino with some like acacia honey, or there's this really, really good pizza at Pepe and Grani in Caiazzo that is like pecorino stagionato, aged local pecorino. And he serves it with like fig jam. And it's like the pecorino stagionato that Franco Pepe puts on his pizza is like, so it's not intense. It's aggressive. So it's like used really, really sparingly. It like almost burns in the way, like in a good way, but in a similar way to the pecorino di fossa, the cave aged pecorino. There is, by the way, like no one making sure that all of this pecorino di fossa is being aged in caves. Like that was just the sort of original production method. Now it's aged in like sort of white tiled, like they look very hospital like storage rooms. But the aging process like really, really intensifies the sharp acidity of the pecorino. As you mentioned, pecorino and fava beans match really well together. And that's a classic combo in Rome on the 1st of May when very, very like tender, some of the first fava beans are being plucked from their vines, are paired with fresh pecorino, or like a fresher pecorino romano. So it's still pecorino romano, still aged a minimum amount of time, but on the fresher side. So like not the 18-month aged pecorino, a little younger. You'll find a dusting on a lot of Roman dishes. The pasta ones I mentioned earlier, picchia po, which is a beef stew with tomato and carrots and celery and onions. Really delicious. But you know what my favorite pecorino dish is?
Tell me.
Saadas.
Oh, that's a great, I'm so glad you brought it up. Tell everyone what they've won.
Okay. Imagine like thin disc of like a round piece of soft cheese. This pecorino is used as the stuffing for more or less a raviolo. And it's like it can be square, but it's usually like round. Cheese raviolo is deep fried and then drenched in honey. This ceadas, which is just one of the dialect names in Sardinia for this delicious dessert, is a classic of the island. And it's got all the best things: melted cheese, something sweet, something fried. It's totally magic. And honestly, like virtually every town in, or every major city at least, has like in Italy has a Sardinian restaurant. And the menus can kind of like feel not Sardinian, but there's always a ceadas on the menu. Always, always, always on the dessert list.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, as you already pointed out, it contains all the basic food groups, so you're never going to go wrong with that. But I think also what I love about it, and it's a great thing for us to wrap up on, it kind of brings together all of that movement that we were talking about, right? It has this sweet and salty, the friedness, the freshness, the many different flavors and textures from across the peninsula. There's clearly the kind of North African and Near Eastern influence there when it comes to the honey against the soft cheese. And the movement of the Sardinian people across the peninsula, as you're saying, it's true. You won't find a lot of regional cooking in other regions of Italy, by which I mean, if you're not in Rome, where basically every region has some kind of representative restaurant, when you're in Tuscany, you're finding restaurants that do Tuscan food. And yet Florence had a Sardinian restaurant for as long as I can remember, and probably has a couple now. I haven't checked really lately, and I don't know when I will be, but the food, the pecorino in the ceadas is also kind of like announcing to us how people and culture move with food and how food moves with them. And the back and forth that you get to consume in that perfect bite is just perfection.
Totally. And as a little side note, we should definitely do an episode on like Sardinian restaurants in Rome, because They are so strange. It's like the place where you go to see politicians with teenage escorts.
It is. There is something, honestly, like now that you're saying that, I actually want to look into this a little bit, because as I was imagining this one, the Sardinian restaurant in Florence, I'm remembering how it felt like stepping into like a weird in-between space that was somehow outside of time and not monitored by the same, that didn't follow the same rules as everywhere else. And there's got to be something going on there. So yeah, let's add that to the list. We got a long list growing now, but don't forget, everyone listening, to keep DMing us with your ideas if you want to hear about us talking about things besides fried cheese. Although, I mean, we could do probably 3 or 4 more episodes totally dedicated to fried cheese without losing our public, right?
Definitely agree. Yeah. So on that note, I might whip up a cacio e pepe.
Yeah, I'm going to have to disinfect my microphone because I've been salivating the whole time you're describing everything. And I will, too, probably just do what I normally do, which is think about cooking something properly for myself and then instead eating a block of cheese and a tin of sardines for dinner while I toast to our still momentarily intact democracy. And look forward to the next time you and I get to talk on the next episode of Gola.
Talk soon. Ciao.